The following episode of FOFOP is rated MA. It contains alternating hosts, a rotating roster of guests, and mild coarse language. FOFOP advises that it is not suitable for anyone under the age of 15, or anyone who came here looking for one of those highbrow NPR-type podcasts. Minors must be accompanied by a parent or guardian. This is John Deek speaking.
Hello and welcome to FOFOP. My name is Charlie Clawson and this is the first FOFOP of 2022, and I have saved one of my favourite guests for this very moment. He's a former TV and radio star. He's a current business mogul, Jules Lund. Welcome to FOFOP.
Mate, it's so great to be here. And when I say here, I haven't moved anywhere. I'm just speaking to a man who's done 4,000 episodes and still doesn't know how to use his microphone.
Well, yeah. I mean, we'll give people a peek behind the curtain. We were just doing our little tech run as we're setting up because you are in Victoria. I am in northern New South Wales. And I couldn't work out why my signal was so low. And then I realized I didn't have a microphone in front of my mouth. But that's the thing, Jules. I've been on holidays for the last 5 weeks. I've forgotten how to do this job.
Charlie, you've got one job, and that's to talk into the microphone. That's all you have to do, mate.
You're clearly unfamiliar with TOFOP's back catalogue. I think it took Will and I about 100 episodes to work out how to use the microphones with TOFOP. And we didn't bring a producer on until like episode 150. And the sound quality and just the overall production of the show increased so dramatically that it actually makes me embarrassed to recommend that people go back. We often, when people say, hey, you know, should I listen to your show? We're like, start around episode 150. Don't listen to anything in that first 2 years.
But come on, mate. It can't be that big a difference. I mean, how many variables have you got? But what, because it edits out all the shit bags?
Well, I don't know. Look, I can't even describe the type of microphones. This is 2010. I ordered something off eBay, like a podcasting kit, and it came with these two, I guess they'd be two condenser mics, but I couldn't work out if these were omnidirectional in that you could speak into any side of the microphone or if you had to speak into a specific. Yeah. And that was like the first 50 episodes, it was a constant discussion between Will and I. It's like, are we talking into the right side of the microphones or does it not matter at all? Or should we hedge our bets and sort of speak halfway between 2 points of the microphone and hope that at least half the mic is picking up our conversation?
I wait all of about 6 seconds before I Google everything.
Right.
Everything. So I would have just gone, serial number, is this? Because there's some boffin out there.
There'll be some YouTube video now, definitely.
Mate, absolutely. And I don't know why people want to give so much. Like, I thought Wikipedia was the worst fucking idea on the planet. Like, you think if someone pitched you Wikipedia and it rests on the fact that people are going to spend their own time for free to write all of that stuff and then, like, keep the integrity of accuracy, you go, there's no effing way.
I think you've hit on the nail on the head. They don't. The accuracy is a huge issue. With
Wikipedia. Mate, I've read yours, and I know you wrote, and a couple of times you said first person. I won the Men's Health ripped cover.
You're right, though. Like with, I talk when we bought this house and I started, you know, doing up this studio and stuff. I went to YouTube University because I am not really a handyman at all. I don't really know anything, but I had to, you know, strip the walls. I had to learn how to sand them down. I had to do like remove doors, had to put up false walls, all that kind of stuff.
You Instagrammed the whole thing.
Mate.
You were
Did I gram it? It didn't happen. I was hoping that I could get some Tribe sponsorship. Can you like hook me up with some kind of like Bunnings or Mitre 10 or someone?
Yeah, okay, Scott Cairns. You've literally done one tiny reno. You're already writing a book.
But the thing was, you're exactly right. Like no matter how obscure the thing was that I wanted to do, if it was like changing a specific brand of doorknob, if it was using a specific brand of kind of paint stripper or whatever it was, I could find some dude in the middle of like Ohio had made like 6 videos on that exact subject. My problem, Jules, and probably, you know, a problem for me in areas beyond home renovation, is that I would pick the host who I found most appealing. let alone, and so their expertise was could be questionable. And so there was one in particular, it was all about how to remove wallpaper. And I'd say that like 75% of the videos I watched, because I watched, say, like five or six videos, said you should buy this tool from your local hardware store, which you just run it over the wallpaper and it puts little holes in the wallpaper, and then you can put like a soluble solution. So then you can just easily remove the wallpaper from the wall. But there was this really cute chick who had a home renovation thing, and she was like, no, you don't need that. Just wet the wallpaper and peel it off. And I watched her videos quite a bit. And I was like, well, I like the cut of this girl's jib. Turns out she was wrong. She was dead wrong. It took me twice as long to get the wallpaper off my walls because this girl led me astray because she was so hot.
I don't mean to be an idiot here, but like most of the guys that come over and fix the shit in your house are guys that can't really do great Instagram work or YouTube work, and there's a reason for it, because they give zero F's and they just want to get the job done. So there's something in that. And I've Googled, in one day I Googled a Haiku big ass fan because it wasn't turning on. Right. I Googled this morning my Garmin Forerunner watch wasn't switching on, and then I just found 15 seconds, hold that button and that button.
Yeah.
And then there was a filter, the most obscure was a filter in a water tank, because we ran out of water at my in-law's house, and there was a sort of air pump, water pump thing, and you dropped it in the water and it looked ancient.
Mm.
And I was able to find the code on it, Googled it, and it basically, we were able to unscrew something and then poke this bit, and then it just fired up. So I think as a human race, we've done very well considering we don't read any manuals, right? If you didn't have Google, you'd, because that precision, no one's going to sit down. Remember years ago, you'd be excited by something, you'd almost open the manual.
Mm.
I've got a parachute. I've got a new parachute and a reserve and a rig for me to jump out at 12,000 feet. I still haven't read it.
What we've done is we've basically outsourced our long-term memory. You know, this is stuff that we used to think about, you know, pre-Google Maps, what you used to do. Do you remember like a street directory? Like, especially if you're driving interstate where you're unfamiliar with the roads, you would memorize, okay, it's three streets before the turnoff, and you would commit that to memory. You'd commit the names of the streets. Now, if I had to go back to using a street directory or, God forbid, a map, who knows? Who knows where I'd end up?
Never forget the 7D to page 59.
While you're driving, by the way.
Choose your own adventure. Can you imagine the Uber Eats and delivery drivers doing that now? The road would be buzzing with just cars stopping suddenly.
Well, I remember our mate Mika, before I went to LA for the first time, saying to me, because it would have been sort of late 2010s, 2007 probably, and her urging me to invest in a GPS. And I was no, I don't need it. I mean, how hard can it be to navigate streets? Everything's a grid, Mika. I can figure this out. But then you get to a country where, like, the street numbers go up into the multiple thousands, you know, and you'll be on an eight-lane freeway traveling at 100 kilometers an hour trying to, like, was the exit San Dimas? Was the exit San Diego? I can't remember what the exit is. And then you end up in a completely foreign country driving down the wrong side of the road. So, because I remember I left the airport without the GPS, I got about halfway down one of the freeways and immediately did a U-turn and headed straight back to the airport and was like, just give me the GPS. I'll pay the extra $5 a day or whatever it is.
And then you download Homer Simpson to guide you?
Yeah. Well, you know what I did actually? I hired a goddamn Mustang, like one of the new Mustangs, or new for 2007. And I was so nervous about, you know, driving on the wrong side of the road and navigating and stuff, that I pulled out of the airport, the car rental place in the airport, and I'm driving down the street. I'm just sort of got all these things going on in my head, and I freaking sideswipe a truck, like just take my rearview mirror and just like scrape the side of the car. And I had that, I guess I went into shock. Like I just kept driving. I didn't stop. I just kept going. And then like got to my accommodation in Santa Monica and was like, oh man, like, what am I going to do? And in my head, it's like I couldn't remember what level of insurance I'd taken out, or I had the insurance and I couldn't figure out if I was covered for, you know, comprehensive or whatever. And so I went through this whole, I created this, turned it to this like huge kind of like a cover up, where I was like, well, I need to get a police report done so that I can go back to the car hire place and have plausible deniability. So I went to the local police department and I tried to say to them, I had my car parked on the side of the road and I went to the shops and I came out and some bastard had sideswiped me, like total projection. This is exactly what I had done to some person's truck. And so the cop was like, okay, cool. He's like, so you're saying your car was parked on the side of the road and you got sideswiped by like traffic? And I said, yeah, but in my head, I was still thinking about what side of the road in Australia we park on. And so the cop was like, but how did you sideswipe? You said you were parked on this street here, but your car would be facing the wrong way. And I just was like, it's fine. And I went through this, I went through probably about a 3 or 4 day sweat box of like, how am I going to get it? And then I eventually just went back to the comprehensive car, the car place and fessed up. And they're like, yeah, it's fine, mate. It's fine. It's a rental car.
Oh my God, yeah.
We're covered. Don't worry about it. To take a new car.
Didn't we scrape the top of the bus when we went to Splendor that straight into the hotel?
That's right.
We just arrived and we just went, all right, we'll park it underneath and just went.
Well, hang on. Wasn't it? So was it your job? It was someone's job to kind of call the clearance. So, yeah, a big group of us.
I was six beers deep.
To paint a picture, about 6 to 8 of us heading up to Byron Bay for Splendor in the Grass. We'd hired, it was like a minibus, right? Like a Taraga or a minibus. We come up to our accommodation, which is a fairly steep driveway into an underground car park, and we were a little nervous about whether or not the van was going to get in, and it was someone's job to get out and just call
it's mine.
The height clearance.
I blame my dad.
Right.
My dad is a shilby right.
Okay.
And when I become my dad about 2 beers in, for the rest of my life, I fight against my dad and I worry about everything because he didn't worry about any.
Yeah.
Right? He was just the eternal optimist, and it used to drive me mad.
Yeah.
She'll be right. She'll be right. Because everything always was right for him, because even if something went wrong, he didn't care. He'd say, she'll be right.
Yeah, because you never have to deliver on the she'll be right, because it's a long game, right? Because it might be bad now, but then it can resolve itself. And so at the point it resolves itself, you say, see, she'll be right. She was right.
But what's the right? Like, he just keeps taking it up into meta heights. So she'll be right. You go, yeah, but I lost my leg. Yeah, but you still get your life. You know, is it? Where does the ride become? No, this is actually quite serious. But yeah, I said she'll be right. But my dad was reminding me of that story when you were just saying, because my dad used to in the old days, 4 years ago, drink drive, and he used to drink drive like all of our parents.
Yeah,
and there was one time he didn't put the park brake on. And it rolled down the hill and took out a few trees on the way. And when he got the insurance guy to come out and assess it, he said, yeah, it was sideswiped. And the guy goes, by tree. Which way was the tree driving, sir? Because look underneath it. It's just got an eucalypts just dragging under the axle.
It must be that must be a fun job, being like an insurance company investigator, because the shit that you would be coming across. Yeah. Like, I've told little white lies. Generally, mine are all to do with rental vehicles. I remember another time I got a flat tire with a rental vehicle and I jacked it up. But you know how underneath your car there's certain points that you put the jack under? Because otherwise it'll bend. The metal's not strong enough. It's not reinforced. I put it in the wrong spot, bent a little bit of the undercarriage, still changed the tire. But I remember looking at it going, it's barely noticeable. I'll just flick some mud on it. Take the car back. The guy does his circle around and just like goes straight for it. And is like, when you changed the tire, did you put the jack in the right place? I'm like, yeah, absolutely. And he's like, because it looks bent there. And then I just lied. I just said,
oh my God.
And then you get all, indignant. Like the more caught out in the lie you are, the more indignant you become.
Oh,
how dare you, sir? How dare you?
I know. I think that's the bit I hate most about myself, that I just carried it from primary school to high school. And now everyone's a teacher worth lying to when it comes to taking responsibility. And I think I think my maturity came to a head when I was in my 20s and Anna, my wife and I were over in Thailand, and we go out on these jet skis and we're fanging like out of Phuket, and we're going really hard and we're going over waves and everything. And then I can't remember. I'm going to blame her.
Never take responsibility.
Either way, we collided and cracked a bit of the front. And I come back and the guy goes, hang on,
you're on two separate jet skis.
Yeah. And we've done a turn and we've knocked it, right? And we've sort of scuffed up the front. And I go back and the guy goes, you scuffed the front. I just automatically start saying, wasn't us. Before I've even realized, like, these guys, it's their profession. There was just no empathy from me. I just automatically just see how quickly I can get out of this. And it got to a point where I was just like, I just stopped and I went, what am I doing? I said, of course it was us. I'm so sorry. Yeah. Like, you guys are, you know, you've put your life savings into these things, but I just had to get out of my own ass, take my head out and just go, how much is it? And then he said the price, it was still nothing. Yeah. And then I am just haggling. I'd spend an hour on the beach. He's holding my passport, mind you.
I guess there is an element of self-preservation that must come in, because I found myself doing the same thing. Like, I remember years ago at the races, you know, Derby Day or something, and I was young, like in my early 20s, and I got very cocky about just wandering into marquees that I wasn't invited to and just like getting free drinks. And I got to the more I did it, the more cocky I became, the more inebriated I became. So then I started sort of moved my attention away from marquees just to people's eskies in the car park. I just go up to someone's esky. And I remember, like, I was getting really cocky about it and saying to my friends, you guys want a beer? You want a beer? I'll go to beer. And they're like, where are you going to get it from? I'm like, I'll just go around for that esky over there. And I go up to this esky and I grab a couple beers and I turn around. There's like two big blokes are standing there like, what do you think you're doing? And so out of the corner of my eye, I see, because, you know, the car park is numbered. It's, you know, 337 to 3. And I'm like, yeah, this is Peter's car park, isn't it? And they're like, who's Peter? And I'm like, yeah, 338. And then I look up and I'm like, guys, sorry. And they, of course, they didn't believe me. And I'm trying to like explain my way out of it. And I'm giving the beers back and stuff. And then I did the same thing where I said, all right, look, guys, I'm really sorry. Like, I was on a roll. I was getting free beers from the marquee. It was really bad of me. Luckily, they didn't kick the shit out of me because they had every right to.
Charlie, was it at that point you thought maybe acting wasn't your career? Since you couldn't even con a couple of tall kids.
Mate, for an actor, I'm a terrible liar. I mean, for one, like, I think, like, I can't get the smile off my face when I'm lying. Like, just generally, like, when I know I'm trying to pull one over on someone, I got the worst poker face. And I think it sort of stems to some kind of, like, Catholic guilt. This is something naughty that I'm doing. And so there is, like, a little bit of pleasure in that.
Sneaking in, though, and I can't grow up. Like, I went to the Geelong Adventure Park yesterday.
Yeah.
And what's
the Geelong Adventure Park? Is that like a theme park?
Yeah. It's amazing.
Is it?
Yeah. Like, it's really good. Like, we went, it's amazing. Like, it's like, you know, hour out of town and it's like just water slides. It's awesome. Mate, we went there as a group. There was about six couples and, you know, 15, 20 kids. And we had the time of our life. Cost you $60 to get in and it was amazing. But I watched this girl sort of accidentally come off her, you know, the big tubes and she goes down the tornado, the tsunami, which are the massive funnels.
Yeah, they're awesome.
Yeah. And she accidentally came off it and she came down and forward it. And I walked over to her and I said, hey, what was that like? She goes, awesome. I said, was it an accident? She said, I said, got it. So when I went up to the tsunami, there was three funnels. They're not as big as the big one.
Yeah.
And as soon as we got on, Carly, you know, our friend Carly Schmidt, so Carl's was on there and another 16-year-old, the son of a friend of ours. And I've just, before the first one, I've just launched off and swung forward. It felt like I went for about half an hour going down. I went there and then I get stuck in the funnel and then the big thing comes down and they were freaking out and then it knocked me out and then the 16-year-old flew out and it was unbelievable. By the time I get to the bottom, I've got the red card. So the lifeguards come over because they've never seen anyone accidentally fall out before the first final. there's no way you could actually fall out.
So the rules are you've got to stay in the rubber tube the whole way down. Yeah, and why? But why is that?
Because it's not made for a human. Like there were some bits that are a bit dry. Because I was flying, a lot faster in some parts than a four-person like donut thing. And oh my God! So I get out, and she's telling me off, and she says, "You know, you've had your first warning." And I just think to myself, "I've been here before." Like I just automatically, I'm 42, right? Yeah. And I'm getting told off by a 15-year-old. Hey, have you ever seen Class Action Park?
No. It's a documentary.
Yes.
I'm going to write
that
down.
It is. So it's called Action Park, right? And I think in the, like, 80s out of Bronx.
Hang on. I've heard about this. Is this one that was just, like, is in the 70s or the 80s and completely unregulated? And Yeah.
So some wealthy cowboy, right, who's just should not have built this thing but just must have had a Peter Pan syndrome, but not a Peter Pan as in, like, you know, Michael Jackson, like, I'm eight. He must have just gone, I'm
Peter
Pan.
Hopefully not like Michael Jackson.
But he's like, no, actually, it never painted him. He wasn't actually, his Peter Pan syndrome was, I'm a 14-year-old who wants to just shoplift and set things alight. It felt
so
like
basically
that.
Every but guy who lives in Bondi.
Yeah, exactly. But that's me, right? My friends laugh at me because I only like films that a 14-year-old boy would watch, like Avengers all the way.
Yeah. Man.
And so this documentary, and it's just got all these people who are now comedians and you know, like entrepreneurs and really successful people in New York City who, and they're our age, right? Mm. And they would say when they were like 14, they would go out as groups of kids and they'd go out to Action Park. And it's called Class Action Park because there were so many injuries. The kids weren't trained. The lifeguards, like people were dying and getting maimed, and they were trying. water slides that just never should have been made. They did a loop-de-loop in a water slide. So just visualize that. It's a tunnel, and it does like what a roller coaster does, but it's got water running through it. So think of the science that has to – think how fast the water has to run, and then think if it's too big a circle, the kid
just drops.
Won't have enough momentum to go around it. If it's too small, they'll get stuck in it. Like, and so – they would just be trialing it, and they'd have like some 14-year-old who's up, who's going to trial this thing.
Amazing.
And they kept getting shut down, and they kept opening up. But it is a fantastic. I think I saw it on Amazon Prime, but Class Action Park all the way. It's a cracker. It's hilarious, and these comedians just talking about their experiences there, and just the absolute perils of going out with your friends and coming back alive and just all your legs. They were coming off water slides, off the sides down the rocks.
Yeah. There's a water slide park up here in Ballina, which is the dodgiest, one of the dodgiest water parks I've ever been. Allegedly. I've got a mate who is our age, and he went there with his two boys who were like 8 and 10. And he went down one of the water slides. He got some air off the lip, came down to the main part of the chute, and then hit the water. And he's like, oh, geez, like, I think I've winded myself. I've got a bit of a stitch. Broke three ribs. And I said to him, do you think it was the design of the water slide? And he's like, well, not that. He's gone, I think the issue is the last time I went down a water slide, I was 20 years younger and about 10 kilos lighter.
Oh, yeah.
Because they are really designed for light people to be flung at high speeds. But the older you get and the more heft you have and the less flexible your hips and joints are, like the more damage you're going to do when you're coming flying out of those things at high velocity.
Yeah, speaking of which, I can hardly move my lower back today.
Right.
Not because of the water slides. It didn't help it, but because I landed quite hard skydiving the day before, which brings me to the question, are you going to come with me, sir?
Well, okay, so are you fully qualified now as a skydiver? Like you can do it? All right. Now, does that mean you can tandem jump with me? Okay.
No.
You can't train me.
Nah. You're not coming with me, mate. Okay. I'm not putting you in a baby horn up the front.
I'll go with you for sure. Like, I've gone skydiving before. I would have no issue doing it. I think maybe Gemma would have an issue with it. Now that we have a small child, she's much more reserved about, you know, taking part in activities that – obviously Anna doesn't have the same concern. She's obviously – she's re-upped the life insurance. She's like, yeah, Jules.
She bought me all the gear. I get the hint.
She's just cutting holes in the parachute.
She said, I packed it myself.
Yeah. yeah, okay. I'll definitely go. But will it be as fun if you're going solo and I'm strapped to some dude?
Yeah. no, we'll do it out of Byron. Yeah, we'll do it out of Byron. Yeah, I'll jump first and then you'll jump after me. Is it still fun? Absolutely. Yeah, because we go up there together. And,
yeah. Well, it was funny. Did I ever tell you about when Gemma and I went? So I got skydiving for Gemma for her birthday. This is about maybe 10, 12 years ago. And we did it outside Geelong and we went up in the plane and I was like totally fine going up, felt very relaxed and calm about it. And Jem went first. So when they opened the door, when we got to altitude, was it 10,000? Is that the jumping altitude?
Yeah.
About that?
Yeah.
So they opened the door and the wind rushes in. I'm like, well, okay, that's a bit of a, that's a rude awakening. And then I see Jem get edged over to the door and then go and just drops like a stone. And then that's when reality sort of came into me. I'm like, oh my God, like suddenly I'm very high up. And so the guy's edging me to the edge of the door. And in my head, I'm like, how can I get out of this without looking like a real pussy? And I'm in my head. But then he said, just cross your arms. And he's gone. Just remember when we go out, when we go into freefall, just scream. He's gone. Because once you let the scream out, you'll involuntarily take breath in because you're going to have all this air rushing at you. So we do that. It's fine. I have a great time. You know, we do the freefall for about 40 seconds and then float all the way down. Get to the ground and Jem's there. And she's like, you know, she's all right. But she didn't seem to have as good a time as I did. And she, so we're just comparing notes on it. And she said, how was the free fall for you? And I said, oh, it was fine. That was probably my favorite part. And she was like, I couldn't breathe. And I said, what do you mean? She's like, I couldn't breathe. Like the air was rushing in so hard. I was trying to breathe. I thought I was going to choke. I couldn't get any air in my lungs. And I said, oh, did your guy tell you to let us scream out and you'll involuntarily take air in? She's like, no, he didn't tell me that. It's like, oh, that's a real shame. So we get our DVDs and we go home and I have a mate round, Ant. And I say, hey, Ant, do you want to watch the DVDs of us skydiving? And he's like, yeah, sure. And so let's put on Gemma's first. And so we put it on. It's one of those preset programs like where you just plug in the footage and it's, you know, all set to the same music. It's, you know, slow-mo walking out to the plane and going up crossfades and all that kind of stuff. And so it gets to the bit where Jem launches herself out of the plane and he's filming on his little GoPro strapped to his wrist. And so Jem goes out and she can't breathe. And so you're watching her like on GoPro like, gasping, trying to get air in. But not only that, but the wind rushing up is blowing her lips back. So like a horse trying to eat an apple, like her teeth are exposed and her lips are flapping around all over the place as she's gasping for air like a fish on land. So Ant and I are watching this and we have got tears coming out of our eyes. It's so funny. And Jen's getting really shitty because she's like, I almost died. I almost died. That wasn't fun for me. But the best bit is they get through that free fall, then they repeat it. And they do it in slow-mo, so we get to see her lips and her teeth sticking out in slow motion. We watched that video, I've got to say, like a dozen times, and each time it was just as funny. We were like on the floor rolling with tears in our eyes. We're laughing so hard. I've got to tell you, Jules, about a day after that, that DVD mysteriously went missing. And Gemma promises me that she didn't get rid of it, but I'm like, you had to have thrown that out. Like, that's the only explanation because I would give anything to see that video again.
Oh, my God. You know, we did one, and I won't name the place like you did with that water park, which you'll have to beep out, no doubt. Otherwise, you'll never be invited back. We did one a bit more north from where you are now. Yeah. It was me, Jacko, Sammy and Spanner, Anna, my wife. So we go up there and there it's their first time. And cause I'd done it on Getaway lots. Right. So, and I'd have to do three at a time because we only had one sort of camera on the ground. You know, they'd get one of me, you know, from the plane, one cameraman, and then he'd go down on the ground and get that one. Yeah. And then I'd probably have one where I'm just staring into the camera on my wrist. This was pre GoPro. So they would strap a Panasonic, you know,
handycam.
No, I'm not even kidding. That they would strap a Panasonic handycam to my wrist right? It was so big. You think from a weight point of view, I could tell you stories. I ran with the bulls with this camera that was on the peak of my hat, and it had a cord that came down to a bum bag with a Panasonic camera. And it had a literally on the peak of my cap at the front, this massive camera lens. We had to fashion this thing. Anyway, so I used to do it a bit. So then I'd take Anna, Jacko and Sammy, who no doubt you've probably had on these, Sammy Kavanagh, on these podcasts. And they're pretty nervous. Like, they're real nervous.
Right.
And I don't blame them. And so we go out there, and as we get and meet our instructors, we jump into the plane, and the plane starts hurtling up the tarmac, and it's a little fixed wing. It's not the, like, they're pretty metal and sharp, like they, you know, because they strip them, right? Mm. It's not a big plane, and we're all sort of huddled in there. And as we start going up, I'm looking at Anna, and she's white. Sammy's white. Jacko's right. Good at everything, so he's fine. And as we go up, I think Anna points out to the wing. And on the wing is the petrol cap. On top of, so the petrol cap hole is there, and the petrol cap is bouncing around, and there's petrol pissing out onto the wing. And it's bouncing around. It's just like, you know, you can imagine it bouncing around, but just, and so we're about to take off. Like, we go, and she points, and then her instructor goes, bang, 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 to the pilot, who turns around and goes, bruh. Anyway, the guy jumps out. He, with his hand, wipes the petrol, gets the petrol cap, puts it in, tightens it, gets some gaffer tape, puts it over the top, just rubs it again, gets back in, and goes, bruh. And we take off. I kid you not. So that sets the scene.
Yeah.
And then from there it was, I don't have any faith in these operators, which it doesn't take much.
So you say you went running with the bulls, skydiving. I saw you do a stunt on the radio once where you drove a car with a attached to a bungee cord off a platform. Have you always been like an adrenaline junkie? Is this something that's happened later in life, or have you always sort of liked this kind of stimulation?
I don't know. As I get older, I feel more dead inside.
Is that what it is? Because I do wonder that. Like, I think there are certain people, because you're not a surfer or anything, are you? Do you surf?
No, I snowboard.
You snowboard.
When in between the drinking.
But is it what is it about the, because there is a level of kind of like personal injury with running with bulls and skydiving, and even like jet skis for some people would be considered like an extreme sport. Like, what is it about that you're drawn to?
I just feel alive. I'm turned on. And I like drama and danger, and when things are going a bit wrong, when there's a heightened thrill. So know me, like we'll be out, and I for decades now I'm good, but you know I'll always
seek out push trouble.
Yeah, I'll look at the fan and go, I wonder what this bag of CCs would look like if it was thrown in. Like, I just like the tension in the air.
Well, you're a disruptor. So, you like to disrupt the norm. Yeah. And I think that's like when that is channeled and controlled, it's a really useful thing. Like, we need people like you because you do think outside the box. But I guess where it's an issue, obviously, is when it's destructive. Because I do have some friends who I feel like, thank God you have extreme sports or whatever it is you do, because I think that energy and that drive you have to kind of feel something or to be pushed, if it was misdirected, you know, it could easily be, you know, driven into like drug addiction or some kind of like unhealthy pursuit. But I remember reading about some, what do you call them? The when they rock climb without, is it called free climbing? Where they climb without support harnesses and stuff.
Free solo.
Free solo, like that guy.
And Before the Dawn. I think it is. There's two incredible. I don't know a lot about climbing, but two incredible documentaries that, worth watching.
But there is an element of not really being able to come back down to a normal level. Like, they pursue these things because that is when they feel the most comfortable and the most alive. Like, I don't know if you feel this, but talking to Osher about hosting, and, you know, Osher, who's been very public about his mental health issues and anxiety and all this kind of stuff, you would think he was the least likely candidate to, you know, host an event in front of 3,000 people at the Opera House, whatever. But he talks about how, well, that's one instance in which he feels in control. Like, every other time, he sort of feels like the world is out of control, and, you know, there's kind of issues lurking in every corner. But then when he has the microphone and the lights and the camera, then he can control what happens. And I think there is an element of that with people who pursue kind of extreme sports, that there is an element of, well, I am in charge of what happens here. The world is a scary, unpredictable place normally, but in this one moment in which I'm on the slope or riding that wave or jumping my bike over whatever it is, then it's up to me and I rely on me.
Yeah.
Do you think there's an element of that with you?
Yeah, with Osher, I actually really like that. I don't know what it is about the skydiving. So I only took it up not at the end of last year, but the year before, so the end of 2020. And I did it because I really felt numb, genuinely needed to wake myself up. And I also think there is levels, as you sort of alluded to before, where, like, I did 10 years of Getaway and, you know, I did hundreds and hundreds of weird things, like everything, like real death-defying and also just edgy things, like even just what I ate, you know, like I'd be drinking blood straight out of the neck of a cow with Maasai warriors mixed with cow urine and milk because I was feeling sick and the witch doctor came over. Like, lots of really, and I just loved living in that realm. So, yeah, since then life has felt a little bit less thrilling, definitely. And so, and especially, you know, I've got a tech company and I've done that for 8 years now and it's just a different world, and I just needed to sort of – I needed a circuit breaker. And the it's funny. It's actually about stress relief. So I wanted to learn how to manage my fear because I was feeling anxiety and fear in what I was doing, which was fake.
Yeah.
Right? So there's no real consequences, you know, like physically to my health and safety. Like, I would feel flight or fight in an email. Boom, right. How am I going to do that? And I'm like, this is fake, right?
Yeah.
So what I wanted to do is actually throw myself in a, you know, in a deadly environment and take that control, manage those fears, rise above it, and actually learn how to, through process. What's extraordinary, it's such a big black ball to go, right, I'm going to never, you know, I've done a few tandems, I'm going to go in that plane up there at sort of like 12,000 feet and then just based on 9 hours of sort of classroom stuff and watching a couple of videos, I'm going to launch myself out of that plane and then, you know, I'm going to pull my ripcord and then I'm going to land a pretty much parachute down 4,000 feet and land safely on grass, right? Wow. So that to me is such a, there's no way I can do that because it's a big ball. But then the ability to break it down and sure enough, trust in the process. And there was just so many great lessons because if you just broke it down, you know, you get scared of big things like, oh, I'm about to become a parent, right? It's just a big ball of black mass.
Yep.
It's terrifying. Yep. And then you go, nah, I'm just going to break this down into things I know I can do. Well, I can do that. I can do that bit. I can buy I can assess what the best pram is. I can, you know, I can support my wife going through that. You know, all these things, you just break it down in the process. And then sure enough, before you know it, you're landing on the grass going, holy shit, I did all that. And so that elation and that pride was really good. But absolutely, I'm in control, as Osher would say, I'm in control of this outcome. And, you know, there are variables around it, but they're pretty fixed, right? Everything in between the parameters is up to me and how I land myself. And so you and I should be the same as me. We would probably worry, overthink, which in that scenario works quite well. What you got to do is you almost got to overthink, get your processes down, and then, like you as an actor, throw it out.
Yeah.
Do you remember you used to do that? Your acting coaches would have said, all right, here's all the motivate. Did you have any acting coaches?
Clearly, you've never seen me act, mate. If you think I have acting coaches. No, but I do understand the idea of being meticulous
pre-history.
Yeah, being meticulous in your preparation, but then working on instinct. Like, I think creatively, not just creatively, but in any kind of task that you approach, it's about getting in, you know, they talk about the flow state and what that means. And it's like, well, it's generally when, I was reading about this the other day in a scientific journal, they're talking about what is the actual neuroscience of the flow state. And it's something to do with when skills meet, the level of skills meet perfect application. So something that you've been training for, you can do it almost unconsciously or subconsciously. And I think that what's fascinating about what you're saying about the skydiving, I want to just go back. You're talking about how you, you know, it'll give you anxiety to send an email or read an email. Have you found that by pursuing skydiving, it has alleviated some of the work stress, like that you now go into those situations like sending the email and it's not a bigger deal? Has it had an effect?
I'm going to say possibly not.
Okay.
You know, I, you know, have my own business, and the last 2 years, no matter what industry you're in, even when it's flying, is, you know, touch and go. We've got 70 staff in 5 cities across the globe. Everyone's going through lockdowns at different times. Mm. And so it's been really stressful and unenjoyable. And I actually now am doing the skydiving because it's the only thing that pushes work out of my brain.
Right.
So in a short amount of time. So obviously I'm on holiday now, and I, you know, as soon as I was able to let go, it took me, you know, whatever, it took me a few days to let it go. But then on a weekend, I wasn't able to recharge because I was just, thinking, you know, still work. Having a, you know, I'm still sort of processing things in my head. But at the drop zone, you don't have a choice.
Yeah.
You're there, and it pushes everything out of your head, and you are so present. Now, that's the state you wish you could do through, you know, TM meditation and stuff. That's the point of it. But I've sort of struggled because it's just been quite a pressure cooker. And so I've used it for that day. And amazingly, when you change your state of mind, when I come back to my work, Just even that short amount of time, and that's the point of meditation. If even just 10 minutes you can escape your environment and rise above it, by the time you come back, it just even feels slightly different. And, you know, at a high level, that's what your holidays are for.
Yeah.
But at a small level through your day, it can be quite difficult going for a run and whatever that state is. But, yeah, I just needed to do something extreme to match the extremity of the last couple of years.
It's funny, I've been a bit lax in my meditation lately, but the last course that I did, which is a Sam Harris, he's got this app called Waking Up, which is more of a neuroscientific approach to meditation. It's sort of, you know, less about, it just feels like a more scientific, less sort of woo-woo approach to meditation. Not that meditation is woo-woo.
You get his guided stuff, and then you get his thoughts on everything from, you know, brain patterns to it's pretty gnarly stuff. But a lot of our friends have that one. It was a bit much for me for a little while.
Yeah, he's interesting, Sam Harris. I haven't delved much into him as like a personality or his, you know, political views. I know a lot of people do not like him, but I just find him to be like a massive nerd. You know, like he just kind of, you know, he breaks down and analyzes, and that probably leads to him maybe being a bit off-putting because he breaks things down into like very sort of like dry, clinical approach to issues which people feel very strongly or emotional about. But the one thing that I found very useful in one of his meditations was this idea of when you feel that kind of anxious thought, that, you know, that racing thought that keeps sending you in a loop where you can't get that thing out of your head, if it's an issue at work or at home or whatever. You know, a lot of schools of thought of mindfulness is about the idea of being like a river and just sort of allowing the thoughts to sort of flow through and you do not fixate. Whereas his technique is different, which is like, well, why don't dive deep into that thought rather than just kind of ignoring it, is just follow it to its origin, you know, like follow it down the rabbit hole and see where it begins. And more often than not, what you find is when you do that, it actually has no origin. Like, you know, it's weird when you're feeling anxiety because generally it's an emotional response and it's a neurological response. And you feel like there is something, you know, like you're saying before, it's like life-threatening. You're responding to an email in the same way you would if, you know, your life was in danger. So you might have specific issues going on, but the idea is that the anxiety you're feeling is just part of your consciousness, you know, and you can give it as much attention or as little attention as you want. And that is obviously the challenge, is sometimes it feels like you cannot shake that thought. And I think it's really healthy to do what you're doing, which is, oh, I'll just find another activity. Like Jem, you know, on the other end of the spectrum has taken up pottery. And she was someone who's tried meditation but didn't work. And then a friend of hers invited her to, you know, come make some ceramics. And it's this beautiful property not far from us, you know, overlooking the hinterland. And it's really quiet. And Jem just goes there on a Monday and it's like, you know, five or six people. And she just makes pottery for like 3 hours. And she says, for her, it's the sort of the tactile nature of being lost in art and making something with her hands. So it's kind of a combination of creative, but also the practical nature. But that gives her real relief. And I'm like, that to me is like, it doesn't matter what the activity is. For someone, it might need to be a real kind of like shock to the system, jump out of an airplane. For someone else, it might be as simple as, you know, working with their hands. But I'm starting to get that as well up here. You know, through coronavirus, I've had to sort of detach from a lot of social media and things I would ordinarily listen to, because I just feel like my head was getting filled with so much kind of information that I was finding it hard to process, and I was getting a bit stressed out. But then being able to exercise, being able to work in the garden, being able to work on the house, being able to do things that are just kind of meaningless in a sense, like weeding the garden, I never thought I would get such pleasure from weeding the garden, but there is kind of like a mindless, repetitive nature to just going around the house and just pulling up weeds with my hands. You get a little dopamine hit because there's a sense of like having achieved a task at the end of it. Yep. But it's also, it's kind of, there's no consequences to my action. If I have to abandon this halfway through, doesn't matter. Like I can get back to it. But, you know, there is a task to complete.
Well, you know me, I've never followed any sport of any kind, but that is, I mean, like I always used to look at golf and just think, why bother? But that's exactly what it is. You're staring at a little white ball. It's quite meaningless. You put a goal on it. And for that time, those, you know, especially, you know, businessmen that do it, you know, they'll be busy. They'll go out there and they'll be staring at that thing. I've got to get that ball to there. Yeah. And it's just focus. And it may as well be a mantra. You may as well be focusing on your mantra in that moment, because it's the same thing. But the other thing you touched on there is, you know, that anxiety where, you know, a neat little trick in terms of, and it's more of a, I suppose, a an easier way to go down and find the origin to expose how meaningless it is. Mm. Often our anxieties and our fears manifest as what if questions.
Yeah.
Shit, what if, you know, what if I don't do it by that deadline? What if, you know, they don't like it? What if? That's what that fear is. And that's where it starts to ruminate. So it, you know, you'll be waking up at 2 a.m. and you're like, really what you're saying is what if? I can't remember who said it to me when I was younger, but they just said, mate, all you're doing is asking a question. Can you just at least commit and give it an answer? And so if you actually answered your what if worries, you would actually get to the next what if and the next. And before you know it, there's actually a scenario there that you can accept.
Yeah.
So a worst case scenario. So for instance, all right, I get that email that I was talking about earlier and it's like, all right, we need to, you know, we need you to present to the global heads that idea that you had. And you go, what if it's not going to work? What if it? And they go, well, if it's not, then I've got the opportunity at that point to be able to actually ask them for feedback. All right, then they're going to get feedback. And what if you know, the feedback that they give me improves it? So you end up sort of going through a part. I didn't explain it well. I don't really have the best example for it. But often what happens, and it needs a real life one, often what happens is, you do arrive at something going, right, you may not get that next job.
Yeah.
And then what happens if you don't get that next job? Well, I can live with that because we've got too much work on at the moment anyway.
Yeah.
And then we can concentrate on higher tasks with people that are less judgmental, and you're worried about these people and you'll be okay. I suppose you get back to what my dad is. You know, she'll be right. But the point is, as soon as you get to that worst case scenario, which you arrive at really quickly, you usually have to answer like three what ifs. And then you go, I'm cool with that. All of a sudden, it stops ruminating because you've answered it.
Yeah. I had a therapist do like a similar exercise with me where I can't remember what the issue was, but it was something about what if this goes wrong. And she said, well, let's play it out. All right. So let's talk about all the issues that, that could go wrong. And you're right. Like it just, with every kind of example I brought up, she could offer like a favorable outcome or a way, is this really the biggest disaster? I think the issue for most people, I should say the issue for me, which I might be an issue for some people, is it's the emotional aspect of anxiety. So intellectually, I can totally understand if you were counseling me through an issue and saying, but Chuck, you know, if that goes wrong, then you can do this. And I can understand what you're saying, but it's inside, I feel like shit. I feel like I'm weak, that I've made a mistake, that we're having an issue at the house at the moment about my parenting where I do this thing where I get frustrated quickly about something and I will have a verbal explosion about something. You know, I drop a pan and food goes on the floor and I'll be like, fuck this or whatever, you know, whatever it is. It's not so much the swearing so much, but Gemma has an issue with me expressing anger over something that really doesn't warrant that kind of reaction. I think that was programmed into me by my father because my dad had a really short fuse and he would often, you know, blow up over small things. He would just express frustration. It would pass very quickly, but he would just, you know, he would just swear and move on to the next thing. And that was one aspect of my dad that I didn't like, was the fact that he always seemed to be like he had this weight of the world on his shoulders and he would express this kind of frustration over stuff that was not an issue. Like, hey, Dad, I've got a flat tire. Can you help me change? Like, oh, bloody hell, blah, 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 you know. It was always this kind of issue. But I think what I'm doing there is it's a fear issue. You know, like there is a little voice in my head that says if you were better at making dinner, you wouldn't have dropped that pot. If you were more reliable, you wouldn't have done this. It's a kind of self-loathing issue. And so I really do have to sort of turn the attention back on myself and be like, if it was you who dropped the pot, if it was a friend of mine or if it was Gemma or anyone else, I wouldn't give a shit. It's like accidents happen, you clean it up. But we always judge ourselves a lot more harshly. I also think too there's an element of performance to it, if I'm honest. You know, I want attention. I want sympathy for the fact that I've just fucked up, and I want people to come rushing. You know, it's a childhood kind of thing. But I do think that there is an element of if you can be mindful of it and check yourself and do that quick investigation of why has this angered me so much? Why am I having such a response? Because I sort of got defensive about it at first when Jim was like, do you have to react like that? It's not a big deal. And I was like, I'm allowed to express frustration. that's okay. I'm allowed to express frustration. But then I realized it's not really expressing frustration. It's just this kind of a disproportionate response to something that's not even an issue.
Yeah. The key is when, you know, you should never bottle up those things if they're at an appropriate level, right? So trauma, you know, crying, disappointment, frustration, you know, like I'm doing this sort of chakra work at the moment, like with a spiral practitioner who's up in Byron, Dana, and it's sort of like over 8 weeks and you go through different clearing things. I'm just trialing everything because why not? You got, you know, people that are specialists in certain areas and I'm curious. And one of them was just anger because I visualize just, you know, I've got a lot of triggers over the last couple of years and I'm the same. I'm trying to, I shame myself for making certain decisions, but I'm actually angry at that. And then I'm defensive in my brain.
Yeah.
Either way, it'll trigger it. And I'll whip myself. Like I'll shame myself and I feel this sense of dread and I feel it quite frequently. Like how could I have got myself into this position or whatever? And I'm doing exact same as you. Like I'm trying to get ahead of it and try to reframe it very quickly. But she was like, you need to literally get an axe and attack crap. Because that's how I visualize it. I end up visualizing sort of breaking stuff. So, you know, as my KK, my sister-in-law gave me those breaking rooms, you know, where you go in, you just smash plates.
Oh, is that a real thing?
Yeah.
Oh, it's great.
I think it's more of a gimmick, but for me, it's like part of my homework. Yeah. You know, you do the axe throwing. We did that for a Christmas party. And this one is you go in and, you know, I think you're meant to go into a room and I don't know if you have a bat or whatever, you're smashing plates or it sounds like a Greek wedding, I have unfortunately jumped the gun of once before. At a Greek wedding, I started smashing all the plates before they told me their special ones. And the poor Nonna was getting sprayed with shards of porcelain. And I was like, well, that's why I came to this wedding. Right?
Yeah, I brought my own plates. I got a boot full of them. When do we start?
I got a baseball bat from Rebel. So anyway, yeah, this room, you go in there, little do they know, like, I'm going to walk out, it'll be like dust in there. You know, people are meant to smash these into bits, but I'll smash it, I'll pulverize it into literally just powder. Yeah. I'll just want to attack this thing. But I've been looking for a good axe and firewood just to attack it because I need, so in that respect, you do need to let certain emotions out. But you're right, that disproportionate amount of response, like my fight or flight with an email, you know, that's our responsibility. And you're right, to Gemma, and, you know, you don't want to pass that modeling on to Iona. And you do. But like everything, you know, swearing, for instance, you know, you don't realize you're swearing. And then, you know, you'll hear it and you go, oh, God, I swear a lot. And then you'll realize you'll swear and then you'll hear it afterwards and you go, I shouldn't swear around the kids. And then you'll swear and you'll go a bit earlier. You'll catch yourself a bit earlier and you catch yourself as you're swearing. And then the key is you've got to catch yourself before you're swearing. And all you're doing, awareness and how, like even yawning at Jetty Surf at Chadstone where I used to work, we weren't allowed to yawn.
Yeah.
Now, when I yawn, I feel like I'm breaking the rules still, you know, 25 years later. But it was like, you know, you would never know when you're yawning and then you catch yourself after, or they tell you, you just yawned and then you go, all right, then you yawn and go, whoop, I hope I didn't get caught. Then you catch yourself yawning and then before you know it, you get all the way up. And that's awareness, right? You're just trying to pull yourself all the way up into before you're doing it. And, you know, going on radio, swearing, you'd really have to do that because it was the profession.
Yeah.
But that's all you're trying to do with your reaction in those moments. And that's where you want to catch yourself. First, you know, Gemma's going to pull you up on it and what your journey is. And you'll be surprised how quickly you get there. And then in that moment, you give yourself the dopamine of not I got attention or whatever, of pride, caught myself.
Yeah.
And that's a good feeling.
You're right, though.
That's change.
You sort of mentioned shame before. And I think that's like, it's such a powerful in a negative way. It's such a powerful factor in how we and dictating our behavior and our approach to relationships and stuff, because I've noticed since I've become a father, there is no shame that I feel more than when I feel like I've been a bad parent. You know, like there's been times where, you know, like Iona won't settle, she's having a full tantrum, and I'll feel that rush of anger and frustration come up, and sometimes it'll bubble out, sometimes it won't. But once everything's calmed down again and she's asleep or, you know, I've had some time to kind of cool off or whatever, God, the shame that washes over me. And I remember on Dad Pod, the pod I do with Osha, you know, we were sort of talking about that. And I sort of felt really guilty about bringing it up because no one wants to talk about, you know, that their kid made them like see red and furious with anger, you know, especially like, she was a baby. But that's when I started to realize that maybe there is something hardwired into me. Like this is something environmental that I've learned about, you know, this is how you cope with adversity or obstacles, is that you get angry and frustrated. And I really consciously had to change my thinking on that, you know? And so I now when, you know, Gemma and I will sort of take it in turns to sort of settle her or even if, it, you know, I've got her for the full day and she's not behaving or she's having a tantrum or whatever, I consciously will prep myself and be like, when this happens, because it inevitably will, she's only going to be this age for a blink of an eye. You are only going to have this moment with her for the blink of an eye. So you need to find a way to enjoy even the tantrums. You need to find a way to enjoy you know, the closeness of being with her. And it's working. It's now to the point where last night she was up at 2 a.m. She's in a real anti-dad phase at the moment where she just wants mum all the time, doesn't want me comforting her. And so I had to chase her around the room. I went into her room because I could hear her awake and crying. I went in there. She screamed when she saw me and started running from me like a Warner Brothers cartoon. She's running in circles while I'm trying to grab her.
It's still so demoralizing though, isn't it? I mean, you just feel so rejected. It's
so unloved. And so I had her there and I she was screaming and trying to push me away and you know, wriggling and I just was like consciously being like, this is a real privilege for you to have the time to be in the room with your daughter. She's not going to be this age forever. And it was just like, I just changed the kind of parameters of what this was about. Like, what does it matter? It's fucking 2 a.m. Have I got better things to be doing? Mm. You know, spend this time with your daughter.
Yes. Like, and then when she, sleeping.
Yeah. But then when she calmed down, I got into bed and we had a cuddle and it was so nice. Like, then I really appreciated the quietness of being in there and like, you know, just this moment of this being just this, just having this kind of this life that I created came from me, Jules. I'm a god in many ways. No, I didn't go that far.
We think it came from you, but anyway, go on.
We haven't seen the DNA results. But that is sort of something that I had, like you say, you've got to consciously sort of go in and then check yourself at each point because emotions can overtake you. And the more we've been talking, the more I think your dad was bloody, he's a genius. She'll be right. It's exactly the philosophy that we should be carrying because he's right. It may feel bad now, but life moves in waves and you might be in a trough now, but it will eventually go up again.
It is. It is always. Honestly, it is always right. But then, you know, if you don't worry, because you can avoid a lot of it, you know, and that's where worry comes in. But again, it's got to be appropriate. Like for you, you were talking about hardwired feeling shame. You should feel shame. We should as parents feel shame because we need to evolve. And, you know, you've got a child there who you can't reason with, right? Mm. And so you have to, you know, you'll blow up and then you'll feel shame after that. And the shame is there. You go, oh, I don't like this feeling. Next time I'm going to change my behavior so I do not feel this shame again. If you keep making the same mistake, you'll keep feeling the shame. So the only way out of it is to evolve, right? And then if you evolve, where it goes wrong is where we've learned the lesson, we've changed it, and now we're still shaming ourselves. And that's where you have to knead out that knot. And that's sadly where we're all caught, where we don't clear that. You know, it's like I've learnt the lesson, right? So, you know, I was telling you the last 2 years, I'm shaming myself. I get triggered and I'm shaming myself. Mm. And in that moment, my journey now is I've got to, when I feel that pang and I'm about to sort of whip myself, I've got to go, no, I've learnt the lesson. I don't have to shame myself anymore. Like I've got that. I hear you. You're right. You know, I should have done that differently. You know, what if I'd done it differently? And then I would have gone down the what ifs paths. And I would have said, well, you didn't, you did the best decision. You made the best decision at the time. Yeah, you're a smart ass now because you're looking back and you're smarter because of it. Mm. But then you weren't. So cut yourself some slack. And as you say, what would you say to yourself if you were your mate? Mm. Because that is a transformative thing. Like whenever you go, what would you say to yourself? What would you say to you if you were your mate or your partner? And it is completely different to our self-talk. It is just miles apart. We are brutal to ourselves. And then to other people, we're so kind. Mm. And we're never kind to ourselves. And when you change that and you start to talk to yourself, you'll channel all of this really positive commentary, right? So, you know, Jim Steins, who you know well, who was my mentor, and he created the Reach Foundation. He was an ex-AFL footballer and you know, superstar, and passed away at 45, unfortunately, with cancer. But I was going through a tough time the other day. My therapist said, what would he say to you? And so I started talking to myself as him, and fuck me, there was shit coming from, like there was concepts, proper concepts coming from nowhere. I was just monologuing. Mm. right? And I don't, I mean, I sort of do believe in the afterlife and I feel him around me, but I certainly don't feel like I was channeling him, you know. But I certainly was saying stuff I would never have said to myself or even, like, it was.
Did you do the accent? Were you doing it in an Irish accent?
I wouldn't. Fucking hell, get you. I couldn't do it. But how'd I go?
Terrible.
But I honestly, there were concepts there. There were thoughts. I'm not just talking about just waffly affirmation and support and encouragement. There were real new concepts, breakthrough thoughts that came from me to myself.
So what do you think was going on there that somehow you were accessing, like, because obviously these thoughts didn't come from nowhere. They're in your subconscious somewhere.
Self-pity. I am in my own racket and my own narrative of self-pity that I'm sick of talking to myself, and the way that I talk to myself, right, is unkind, and it, and I think I like being in this pity party.
Sure.
And I just, I don't know. It's like I access this victim mentality. Whereas when I was trying to be someone talking to me, I was looking at the positives so much more. I was looking at the learning of it. And it was, I mean, I can be specific. It was just like, I've done 8 years of work and, you know, it's been tough lately. And he was just saying it, you know, and he was saying, it's not what you get from it, it's who you become, which I sort of say to myself a lot. Like, it's but the way the words came through him in that moment was just like, and he was always a bit, he was just a great teacher. It was really about, oh, actually, it's all about, the whole 8 years has been about this tough part. Like, you know, like at the gym, you do 8 reps. You don't do it for the 8 easy reps. You do it for the failure of the 7 and 8. And you can't just skip to the 7 and 8 because they are the 1 and the 2. Do you know what I mean? You have to go through all the stuff, right? And you only get the growth. You only tear those muscle fibers from failure, from the bit where you struggle and you're striving. And there's no way to get to that. He's like, it's just, the whole point of this whole chapter of my life is about this moment, how I conduct myself, how I do it with generosity, how I don't misdirect my frustrations to my wife and my kids, how I contain it, how I think positively, how I give myself all the best chance for the greatest stamina of water and sleep and exercise and meditation, and just all this stuff. He's like, this is the bit. This is the whole point was this bit. So you're here now, and this pressure is a privilege, and you've earned it, and it's unpleasant, but this is the becoming. This sort of part of the obstacle is the whole, this is the slaying of the dragon. This is the bit. You've got here now. Don't sort of pull a ripcord and get out of it. You've got here. Now let's see who you are. What are you made of? And I don't know, I reframed it pretty quickly, and I was not using those words and that approach myself, and yet there I was talking to myself without the Irish accent.
I mean, I think it's really interesting. You do almost have to do an exercise like that because you're not going to get that perspective from being Jules Lund, like being where you are in your situation. It's almost like you do have to detach, because I often say about writing, for instance, like you know, I find writing so difficult, and the first 4 hours is agonizing, and you hate yourself and you're no good and why are you even trying? And then something happens in the last 2 or 3 hours where it's like you just don't want to stop. But there is no, like you say, with the reps, there's no way to fast forward to those last 3 hours. You have to do the 4 hours where it sucks and you hate yourself to get to that kind of flow at the end. But then it's not like... it's not like every time you sit down, you can, the change is so incremental. It's not like every time you sit down, you're like, well, I'm a better writer than I was yesterday. It feels like you still don't know anything every day you sit down. It's only over the course of time that you can look back and go, oh, well, you know, I've made significant strides. I've sold this, you know, or this has worked, or this has been made, or this hasn't. But it's really hard when you're in the midst of that trough or that down period, which it sounds like you are at the moment, to get perspective. Because it just feels, everything feels like a slog, and you don't know, there's no, you know, when I'm really at my low points, I'm always saying to Jem, like, but how do I know this is the right course of action to take? How do I know I just haven't committed 6 months to a year to something that'll be meaningless? And she's like, you don't. But that's the point. Because if it was easy and the outcome was guaranteed, then everyone would fucking do it. The point is, you know, especially working in a freelance or creative field, you have traded off security and you've traded off surety for something else, you know. And when Gem and I had the production company and I was producing for her, I used to get so stressed out the night before a shoot and I'd stay up all night thinking up every contingency. Okay, so if this specific situation happens, what am I going to do? Okay, well, I'll get that, blah, blah, blah. And that's what producers do. You're constantly kind of problem solving. But then I sort of got to a point where it's like I would always be amazed that the day of the shoot, I would step onto set and everything would just happen and people would do their jobs and occasionally things would come up. But all that time I'd spent, you know, trying to kind of anticipate every single contingency, every single problem was just pointless because there is no way I could anticipate the exact minute factors that would go into a certain thing happening. And in many ways, when something big disastrously did go wrong, that was almost the best time because, you know, that's what we're talking before about you getting to the flow state. That's when I would just have to rely on instinct. I remember we did this shoot in we're still living in Melbourne, but we're doing a shoot in Sydney on one of Sydney's beaches. And I had spent so much time getting permits for this and permits for that, I'd completely forgotten to get permits to shoot on this beach. But we're going to be there at dawn. You know, we'd be gone by like 8 a.m. I had sort of like it wasn't a huge factor in my mind. So we've got like, you know, 40, 50 crew down there. We've got the artist, you know, in the water. We're shooting her, you know, this beautiful sunrise. She's frolicking in the water. And this lifeguard drives up in his buggy. He's like, who's in charge here? And this man's like, you got permits to be shooting here? And I'm like, fuck. Like in my head, I forgot to organize permits. And I'm like, yeah, absolutely. Just come with me to unit. We'll get it out. So I walk, you know, as slowly as I can so they can get shots. And I get to my little folder and I'm like, oh, God, I'm sure it's here. And then I say to him, mate, look, I'm really sorry. I don't know where the permit is. Maybe it's been lost in the mix. I'm sure we have it. But if we didn't, what would you say we should do? And he's like, well, you have to get a permit or I'm going to shut you down. And I'm like, okay. So would you have the number of the person in the council? And he's like, well, it's so-and-so. So he gives me this guy's mobile number. It's like 7 a.m. So I say to my AD, just keep rolling. Like if he tells you to pack up, just pack up real slow and just keep rolling. So I call this guy. Hello, my name's Charlie Clawson with Blackberry Films. Listen, we've run into a bit of an issue. I don't know how it happened, but we've got to get a permit. Are you able to come down and issue a permit now? And the guy's like in bed. And I don't know if it was just because I caught him, you know, half asleep. He's like, sure, I'll be down in about 20 minutes.
Aww.
And so I was on my phone filling out an application, $500 fee or whatever. So running to an ATM to pull the money out. The whole time I'm juggling all this kind of stuff. Managed to get it all done. Got the permit approved. Literally handed the dude the permit as we're packing up to go. Like we've got everything we needed.
That's unreal.
And handed the permit. But that was probably like the most stressful thing that was going to happen on that entire shoot. And it was, there's no way I could foresee that have coming. And it worked out fine. You know, like I was experiencing that situation. I'm working with a professional crew. If your dad was there, he would have been saying to me, she'll be right. Like, what's the worst that's going to happen? He shuts you down. Yeah. You get the shot somewhere else. You pack up and move to another beach. You just keep going to beaches until you keep getting shut down. Like, there is a way around that problem. But I think, you know, to go back to very early in the conversation, your brain just starts thinking up the worst possible scenarios. And then, like you say, the shame comes in and you're an idiot for not anticipating this thing you had no way of anticipating.
But also there's two lessons in that. The first one is how you conduct yourself. Like that's what you control. That's what I'm thinking a lot more and more about is who am I in that moment? Not what do I do, but who am I? Who am I to the guy that comes up, the lifeguard? Yep. Who am I to your team? That's your journey. Who are you when you drop the pan in the kitchen?
Yeah.
You know, who are you in that moment? And that's worth aspiring to, and we are in that control, right? So that's a fun little exercise and little mastery worth doing. But the other piece, and I don't know if you've heard this in years, remember Sunscreen, the song from Romeo and Juliet?
Yeah.
So you've got to play that again because it was in 93, I think.
No. So that would have been
96? 96.
96, 97.
So it was around 96. And it was, I think, Baz Luhrmann. It was spoken word, sunscreen. It was all these sort of, you know, pieces of advice. And I mentioned it to Sammy Cav the other day, and he's like laughing at me. And I was like, press play on it, because there'll be something that speaks to you. There'll be one or two lines. And it did. It was like one of the lines was basically what you just said, which was, you know, don't worry, because, you know, you'll soon realize, because I was talking to people, you know, kids who are in their early 20s, right, about the life ahead. Mm. And I said, don't worry, because you'll realize that worrying is about as effective as, you know, solving algebra by chewing gum. And you'll also realize that the biggest challenges in your life, you never anticipate. They just hit you, you know, one Tuesday morning, and you have to just react to it. And that's actually it's exactly what you just said. And that is actually, there is some wisdom in that. All the things that you worry about in your life, it's the stuff you don't worry about that actually tests you.
Yeah. And it's just, and the stuff that does worry you, don't worry, because she'll be right.
She'll be right, Kenny.
Jules, thank you so much for being our very first guest on FOFOP for 2022. I'd love to have you back on. I'll pick a time where you are not being slammed by work. Hopefully won't interrupt any more of your holiday time. We'll have to find that window in between work and skydiving and holidays where I'm not eating into your very precious,
actually,
relaxing time.
After a skydive.
Oh, that's perfect. When you're just charged with adrenaline or depleted from adrenaline, depending on how you are.
Hi, Charlie!
Do you have anything you want to promote or plug?
Nah.
Okay. I'm Charlie Clawson.
I'm Jules Lund.